It's Monday, November 1, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The coming week is likely to size up as one of the largest in terms of news and political developments, as well as trends and trajectories in the larger culture. We are now entering the last day of the election cycle for the mid-year elections for the year 2010. The political level of activity is incredibly high, and of course, there's now intense political speculation. Even as entering into these last hours, there's actually very little either party or any candidate can do to shape the outcome of the election. Now, even as we say that, approximately 30% of Americans in polls say that they are undecided about how they will vote tomorrow. That tracks just about customarily for every major election. Hard as it is to imagine, given the stakes of the issues, as both sides would agree, given the issues as framed by both parties and all candidates, it's hard to imagine that any intelligent person could be at this point undecided and unsure about his or her vote. That tells you something about the fickle nature of the American population. It tells you something about just how the voting process is indeed imprecise, and democracy is, as Winston Churchill said, incredibly sloppy. In Churchill's words, it is the worst form of government ever invented, except for all the others. So what we're going to see in this pageant of democracy as America goes to vote, or at least as something like 50% of eligible voters, as expected tomorrow, go to vote, what we are going to see is that the issues actually become tangible votes, as voters are no longer asking questions asked by a pollster or a survey taker. They're now actually making a vote. And a vote, of course, is among forced options, unless you're in a race where you intend to do a write-in. But no write-in candidate has won any major office in America in decades. All that might change tomorrow, as there's a very real possibility, for instance, in the state of Alaska, that a write-in candidate may win the U.S. Senate race. We'll watch the issue with you and the developments tomorrow, but the likelihood is that there are going to be plenty of surprises by the time we get to the results coming in on Tuesday night. Oh, and by the way, there is good reason to expect that at least in some races, the vote will be so close that we actually will not know tomorrow night the outcome in several congressional and senatorial races, perhaps in at least two or three states, the gubernatorial races as well. But we'll have a sense of the trajectory. We'll have at least a good idea of the larger pattern, and we will all have a great deal to talk about come Wednesday morning. In the meantime, let me remind you to vote. It is a Christian responsibility to participate in the political arena, not because there is a particular dignity to politics, but because love of God and love of neighbor require that when we have the opportunity, we choose the better and not the worst option. We seek to elect those who will uphold righteousness and justice and not those who will do otherwise. We seek to choose those who will do right, and we seek to encourage others to do likewise. The political process is not magical, but it is essential as we come to understand our Christian responsibility. Christians expect too much often out of politics. On the other hand, some Christians expect too little. In a fallen world, government has its role, and Christians are supposed to be the people who think seriously about that, not just in terms of political effect, but in terms of Christian responsibility. Now, just about anyone who's been observing the political process of the current moment with any seriousness knows that there is likely to be a change in the majority in the United States House of Representatives. There is also now the very real and live question as to the future of the partisan balance in the United States Senate. Now, most political pundits are looking to a Republican sweep of many offices, at least enough to gain a clear majority in the House of Representatives. A swing of between 55 and 70 seats is not inconceivable. In the Senate, however, there would have to be a net shift of 10 seats, and that comes at a significant disadvantage in terms of the traditional reelectability and longevity of United States senators. Again, something to watch tomorrow night. But here's something to keep in mind. There are some issues that simply are not on the political debate, that have been, at least in the last several election cycles. First and foremost on that list would have to be the issue of our two wars, the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. As Elaine Cooper of the New York Times reports, Democrats in particular are staying away from this issue, even though they've talked about it a great deal in the last several election cycles. She writes, "Both Democrats and Republicans appear to have decided that talking about the wars is not in their best interest. Democrats are divided on the war and do not want to air internal divisions in a year when they have so many other problems. Republicans are unified in support of the war in Afghanistan and Mr. Obama's decision to send more troops there, but see no need to stress an issue on which they are more or less allied with him." End quote. Now, I raise this issue in order to point out that often what we find most interesting in a political equation, or any other cultural equation, is not so much what is present, but what isn't. In this case, it is nothing less than noteworthy that we have an issue that has framed so much of the debate and consumed so much of the political air in the last several election cycles, but this time is not mentioned. Why is it not mentioned? Is it because it is not important? Is it because it is not front and center in terms of this nation's security? Not at all. It's because that neither party, and very few candidates, see it as an advantage to have this war discussed or debated. For that reason, when you have neither party seeing it to their advantage, both parties remain relatively silent. But the silence on the war does not mean that it is not an urgent and ongoing issue for the American public. Of similar interest is what is on the ballot. We've discussed from time to time Proposition 19 on the California ballot, the ballot initiative that would legalize and regulate marijuana in that state. A yes vote on Proposition 19 means that California could become the first state basically to decriminalize the possession and sale of less than 1 ounce of marijuana. Now, looking at this issue, something very interesting appears. You talk about a cultural conflict in America of a generational kind of pattern, and you would think that you would know exactly how this would come down. You know, traditionally, when you talk about marijuana, you're talking about a group that's likely to be arrested at younger ages. But it turns out that a great deal of the support for the legalization of marijuana, for the decriminalization of its possession and sale, is coming from aging baby boomers who turn out not to have gotten over the 1960s and the 1970s. There are some college students involved, however. As the New York Times reports, reporter Jesse McKinley says this, quoting a college student named Evan Nielsen, a junior from Ithaca College in New York, he says, quote, "This is one of our generation's most important issues. Students are going to be the deciding factor, and I'm in charge of colleges. Talk about stress," end quote. Well, this young man may be bearing stress, but the reality is that if he thinks this issue is one of the most important issues for his generation, he's just pointing out the political, economic, and personal immaturity of a generation. Now, interestingly enough, there are shifts going on in the Proposition 19 polling that indicate that Californians who had been seriously toying with, after all, adopting the legalization of marijuana may be having second thoughts. One of the reasons is this. When the law was actually framed, when the issue shifted from, should we decriminalize the ownership or sale of an ounce or less of marijuana, to the actual construction of a law, there had to be legal definitions and very clear procedural policies put in place. And then there came the recognition that this state just might be buying into more than it had bargained for. What do you do when, after all, a state is unable to keep teenagers from smoking tobacco? What happens when, at school, they have to worry about marijuana, which, after all, at that point would not be illegal, but would certainly be out of bounds? And then there is the reality that California, which is already facing the closest thing to a state bankruptcy that any American state has seen in recent decades, could be losing a great deal of federal funding because, after all, there are federal laws that criminalize the possession and sale of any amount of marijuana, and the federal government does not concede that territory to the states. Another voter initiative to watch is going to be on the ballot in Arizona. Arizona's ballot question number one is the question of whether judges should be popularly elected or if they should be put in place by a special nominating commission. That may sound like a fairly innocuous choice, but as it turns out, of course, it is not. The energy behind ballot question number one is coming from trial judges and others who want to remove the voice of the people from the election of the state's judges. Now, interestingly enough, someone rather famous has entered into this debate. That person is retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who has recorded voicemail messages for advertising for this initiative, and a good deal of it is coming from her own Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System. Now, fascinatingly, Sandra Day O'Connor says that the popular election of judges is a process that, in her words, are, quote, tawdry and embarrassing. Well, what we're seeing here is an effort to remove the voice of the people from the election of judges and to put it in the hands of a legal elite who would have a disproportionate influence, therefore, on the course of jurisprudence in that state. Now, we also have something else here, and it is a word that has come up again and again in this election cycle. That word is elitism. What we have in the case of ballot question number one is an attempt to say that the people are not qualified to choose judges. Now think about that for just a moment. That is certainly an insult to the American population when it comes to electing any other political office. How is it that Americans will be qualified to elect a president, to elect senators, after, of course, it took a constitutional amendment to lead to the direct election of senators, to elect congressmen, representatives, to elect, after all, the state's governors and legislators? How is it that all of a sudden when it comes to judges, citizens are not to be trusted? The reality is that elitism in the legal field is deadly dangerous. It is, frankly, in almost any field of endeavor, but in the law, it is even more dangerous. Because when it comes to a procedural democracy, when it comes to the dignity of the law and the respect and integrity of the courts, it is required that the people, yes, the people, have confidence in their judges. And that means that the judges, yes, the judges, are finally accountable to the people, and not the other way around. This edition of The Briefing is coming to you from Washington, D.C., where over the weekend, of course, the march in Washington was the one sponsored by Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, two comedians, two satirists of Comedy Central, who brought their comedic talents to a political mobilization that they declared would be nonpartisan. But as even the New York Times indicates, if they were nonpartisan, the crowd certainly wasn't. Liberal groups like Media Matters, NARAL, that's the National Abortion Rights Action League by its previous name, and other groups, including People of the American Way, were organizing there during the event. And it was an embarrassment of sorts to our political culture that so many of the most important issues of the day ended up being satirized as fodder for the kind of comedy that makes for laughs on cable television. But of course, sometimes politics deserves to be satirized. And we'll be watching what happens this week to find out just how much of the laugh is on us. Finally, the attempted terror attacks this past weekend, attacks in which explosive devices were placed upon cargo aircraft destined for the United States, this is a reminder that we are facing a very real enemy, that terrorism is a very real threat, and it isn't up for a vote. All the satire and sarcasm, all the energy and bloviating of the political campaign will soon be left behind us, but we're still going to be facing enduring problems. Christians are those who trace those issues to Genesis 3 and understand that we're living in a fallen world in which nothing, including especially no political effort, will ever remove that fundamental problem. We also know that we have a responsibility, a political stewardship, and exercising that is also a matter of our Christian discipleship. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/AlbertMoeller. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.